Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Beautiful, beautiful Sunday morning out there. A lot of moisture around. I know San Antonio got pretty much pounded overnight. Real good rains here. I got a little less than 7/10 up in Bernie area. My partner got a little less than 1/2 inch up for Bergheim and Candelia, so just about everybody got a good rain, not enough to really boost the rivers or the aquifers or Canyon Lake, unfortunately, but sure enough to keep that grass green and help things grow a bit, help all these beautiful trees just leafing out. Anyway, just a nice, nice Sunday morning out there after a good rain overnight for most everybody, at least in this area. Lots of things to talk about, lots of things to do, but most important is what is on your mind. Looks like Shirley, David, and Judy are already waiting, so with no further ado, let's get to the phone line. Shirley's up first. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a problem with a lawn I'm trying to revive. I've had to neglect it for about 2 years. Now, it still has some carpet grass, but it's got a lot of weeds and winter grass.
Uh-huh.
What do I need to rejuvenate that lawn?
Well, first of all, don't worry about the weeds. For the most part, they're going to die out, you know, as the weather warms up. Most all the weeds we're seeing now are cool weather weeds. So all you need to do there is mow. To rejuvenate your other good grasses, be they St. Augustine or Bermuda or Zoysia, whatever, a good fertilizing with any of the good organic fertilizers. And the best thing would be, and it, you know, it's laborious, but get somebody to spread some compost. Just 1/4 to 1/2 inch of good compost will probably do more to revitalize that grass and get it spreading into the grassless areas and anything else you can do. The fertilizer is important to give the nutrients you need, but I don't know of anything that will revive a stressed lawn better than a little bit of compost on it.
I have a friend in Austin, and she listens to a garden man there, and probably he had suggested spraying with seaweed and then liquid molasses.
Seaweed and molasses are a great thing to spray with, but doesn't really provide any nutrients. The one thing I would do to that is add maybe a little garret juice, add maybe a little liquid fish, but seaweed molasses is the spray that I use in the vegetable garden to stop spider mites on flowers. Only thing wrong with using it on flowers is that the molasses can kind of stain things brown, but that would be an excellent thing to do, but it doesn't really provide much of the basic nutrition, so a little fertilizer along with it would certainly help. The compost just brings so many micronutrients and humic acids and things like that, but no, liquid seaweed molasses is a great combination, but by itself I don't think it'll produce the results you're expecting.
Okay, other thing, we have some oak trees, and one of them dropped its leaves early.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, God, I think it's dying. But now it's full of blooms.
That's a good sign.
I think I need to feed that tree with something. I know you talk about the sick tree treatment, but I'm not sure exactly what that consists of.
Well, it's a combination of things, but you know, oak trees are individuals. Even though there may be 1,000 live oaks in your neighborhood, every one of them has a little bit different genetic makeup, and some of them, you know, are going to always drop a little early or drop a little late, and I wouldn't be concerned if the tree is leafing out well at this point. It's obviously not in any serious problem. I would definitely look at the trunk and be sure that it kind of broadens out, that you have what we call the root flare as the trunk gets close to the ground. If it looks more like a fence post sticking up, somebody needs to dig the soil out from around the trunk until you get down to where that root flare is. But I would not be concerned. You know, we've got live oaks and cypress and everything, and I've got hundreds of them on my ranch. And, you know, some of them are full of leaves now. Some of them are just starting to leaf out. Some of them are still completely bare. Of course, I'm a little bit further north than San Antonio, but that's really not unusual. And as far as fertilizing, the same thing you put on your grass will benefit your trees. What I usually do is if I'm out pushing that fertilizer spreader around feeding the grass, I'll just make two or three extra passes around the trees, and that gives them the extra nutrition they need.
Okay, and I have called you several times through the year or two about my Monterey oak that I was trying to, that this man planted and I was trying to save. But I think I'm going to have to give up on it because I think now it grew and I did all the stuff you said, but I looked around it recently and the roots are still going in a circle. But I think the tree is dead. And I think what the problem is the water stands in that area. Would that kill a tree?
Oh, absolutely. It's not the water that kills the tree, but when the water drives all the oxygen out of the soil, a plant's roots have to have oxygen, and where water just stands and stands, water drives the oxygen out of the soil, and that's what kills plants. It's just like if, you know, somebody stuck your head in a bucket of water for 10 minutes. The water didn't kill you. The lack of oxygen did, and the tree roots are the same way, and that could easily be the problem, and sometimes that's a difficult one to correct. I always tell people if you want to plant a tree in an area where water tends to stand like that, create a raised bed or berm it up or do something to, you know, give the roots the oxygen they need. When we first opened the nursery here many years ago, we planted two big oak trees, not realizing what a high water table we had, and they promptly died within a few months because of exactly the problem you're describing. We built up, and at that time we were using railroad ties, we built up raised planters and came back in and planted more oaks, and those are magnificent, beautiful trees today. So if you decide to replant in that area, if your tree truly is dead, I wouldn't give up on it for another couple of weeks because some of the Mexican oaks, some of the Monterey oaks are just slow to leaf out, and they suffered from the cold, the combination of the heat, you know, very hot, very dry, and then having it very cold. I've seen a few around that, you know, that have actually died from that, but it may be the combination of too wet, too cold, and, you know, too extreme last summer. But I'd give it a couple of weeks before you give up on it. But if you do decide to replace it, anything you plant in that area, unless you can put in a French drain or something to drain the area, create a raised bed because, again, that's what we did.
How large?
To plant a good oak tree, maybe 5 feet in diameter.
Okay.
But, yeah, if you ever by our way, take a look at our big oaks out back. You'll see them raised up. Railroad ties are sort of deteriorating. But that enabled those trees to put their roots in the area where they could still find oxygen and what they need. And those trees have thrived over the years. So doesn't mean you can't plant in a wetter area. You could also switch to a tree like a cypress, a bald cypress or something like that, that really doesn't mind. It'll even grow in standing water because of some special features its roots produce to help get oxygen into the root system that are called knees. But let's give it a couple of weeks. If you decide you want to replace it, call me again and we'll talk about what your options are.
Okay, I have another question.
Okay.
Martins.
Uh-huh.
We used to have lots of martins.
Right.
And last year we didn't get any, and this year they don't seem to have come.
Don't, again, the martins are just now arriving. A lot of people that have colonies, they still haven't come. And most of the people that I talk to that do have a colony, they're not as many as usual. We don't know whether they suffer from the cold last year. But it's martins are odd, and apparently they have long, long memories. And if something bad happens around their colony, and this happened again to my partner. She had a ringtail or something got up while the birds were nesting and killed a bunch of the babies, and that was 4 years ago, and the martins have still not come back. So sometimes they will abandon an area because, you know, they had an issue with a squirrel or a raccoon or ringtail or something like that. But at this point, kind of like your tree, I wouldn't worry for another couple of weeks, because of the people I know that have purple martin colonies, only about a third of them have had their martins back yet this spring. It's still a little early. It's just like the hummingbirds. There are a few males hanging around now, but the big numbers of hummingbirds have not arrived, so don't despair quite yet.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the encouragement, and
well,
I appreciate all your information. I've tried to call you for two different weeks, and I finally got in today.
Well, I'm glad you made it through today, and you get out and have a wonderful, wonderful Sunday, Shirley, and we'll talk again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you much.
Bye. You're welcome. Goodbye. All right, David and Judy, hang on just a second. Let me get a quick break in here. Looks like I get to talk to you about Azomite. My friends at AgriMen Solutions that bring you Azomite want to remind you that it's just the best micronutrient source out there. It's a natural ore. It's not anything synthetic or man-made, but it is it's a very special product that has close to 100 different micronutrients and micronutrient compounds that benefit your plants. The most obvious thing you usually see when you use the Azomite is how much things green up. It's the only product I've ever seen where you can take a plant with yellow leaves due to chlorosis, and those leaves would actually turn green again. Many chlorotic plants, if you treat them with green sand or something like that, the next set of leaves that comes out will be much greener. But Azomite often even greens up the leaves that are there that are already yellowed. It's a great thing to use when you're planting your vegetable garden, your flower beds, great thing to use on your grass, or just about anything where you want to be sure that it gets all the nutrients that it needs. Doesn't replace your basic nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium fertilizers, but it's like having just the best vitamin supplements you've ever seen. Comes in two forms, a very finely powdered form that can be put into suspension and sprayed. One that I like most is a granular form, and you just sprinkle it around. Don't even have to water it in. It will never burn. Doesn't really go to work until it gets moisture, but easy product to use, safe product to use, not an expensive product. It just works wonders for your plants. Azomite spells Azomite.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Next three callers are David, Judy, and Jan. David's first in line. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
Oh, it's just a beautiful morning after a nice rain. Life couldn't be much better than that, unless we were out fishing or something like that.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we got 3/4 inch last night ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is
good rain.
Because usually just goes right around us here, but we got it last night.
We call it the Bernie split. This huge storm comes right towards you, and then it just splits, goes around, and reforms on the other side. But I'm like you. I didn't get quite that much, but very happy for what I got. And I hope it's a trend that's going to continue. I hope we're not headed into another dry summer, but we'll see. It'll do what it'll do.
Yes, sir. And I got my first tomatoes yesterday from plants I nursed over the wintertime.
Very good.
They're pretty good. Anyway, last winter I searched high and low for a bag of Prevent from Nature's Creation.
Uh-huh.
And I finally found some from up north Texas. Had to have it shipped down here.
Right.
And we have this new guy working for us, and I told him to go out to the white shed and grab a bag of Growing Green by Medina Ag that I purchased from Morales Feed and Seed and Divine.
Uh-huh.
And put it out under the trees that I purchased from Fenix Nursery. And he returns an hour later, and he tells me he ran out of fertilizer. And I said, you use 11 bags of Growing Green? And come to find out, he had grabbed the Prevent and put it under the trees. My question is, I'm guessing that it's not going to hurt the trees any.
Prevent is not a product that I am familiar with. Do you know what the active ingredient is? Most of what Nature's Creation does is organic rather than synthetic, or at least natural. I'm guessing it's probably corn gluten meal.
Yes, sir. That's what it is. It's
okay, yeah.
By nature's creation, yeah.
Corn gluten meal is high in nitrogen. It's actually got more nitrogen in it than the growing green does. It doesn't have all the micronutrients. It doesn't have the mycorrhizal fungi, some of the other things that Medina puts into the prevent. But your plant's got all the nutrition they need, even though it wasn't the product you intended to use. And 3/4 of an inch of rain on top of it is good. I have had the experience. I used a little too much corn gluten meal in the vegetable garden one time and burned some tomatoes with it. But I'm virtually certain that you won't see, you know, any negative side effects. I would be sure that your trees get a deep watering periodically. But unfortunately, that's a very expensive way to feed your trees, but I really don't think any harm was done.
All righty. And can I still put the growing green around them, or do I need to wait a while?
Wait a month. It wouldn't hurt to put it out now, but, you know, let's, you know, save the money as we can. Your trees have got enough to hold them at least for the next 4 to 6 weeks. I would wait that long, then put your growing green out and figure you're done till early fall.
All righty. All right, thanks a lot, Bob. Appreciate your time.
Well, always a pleasure, David. Good question, good call. Next in line is Judy. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm getting ready to have some compost and growing green put down in my backyard because it just looks horrible. It's
okay.
All weeds and oxalis and everything. But the person who's going to do it suggested that I also put sand down.
No, sand. I mean, if you wanted to buy lava sand, a very coarse sand or something like that, you could. But sand plus clay makes concrete. Sand in most situations will make your soil harder rather than softer. So I would very definitely stay away from the sand. Like I say, if you were getting a very coarse sand like lava sand or granite sand, you wouldn't have as much problem, but you still wouldn't gain a whole lot. The compost is going to do what you need to do as far as loosening and improving the soil, so I'd leave the sand where it is.
Okay, I had that feeling. I thought, gosh, I got to call Bob, you know. So
No, years ago, I, like most other people, figured, oh, sand's going to loosen things up, but then I learned that literally you mix sand with clay, and it makes the soil harder rather than softer, so not really a good thing to be doing. Now, old Malcolm Beck used to mix something called Poteet Red Sand, which is a different type of sand, with compost and use it as a top dressing, but no, just putting sand on your yard, bad idea.
Do they still mine Poteet Red Sand?
I don't know. I haven't seen that on the market in a long, long time.
Yeah, it's the first I've heard of it. I know Poteet's where they get sand, I thought.
Well, there is you're right on a couple of different, I guess the geology is slightly different, and you've got a couple of different sandy products. But while I wouldn't hesitate to, you know, get a sandy soil or something like that to do raised beds or whatever, just sand plus, you know, what we have in most of San Antonio would wind up making it harder rather than softer. And even what Malcolm did, he recommended only on the surface. And it's just expensive, and it's something I don't think you need to do.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you very much. I appreciate your advice.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate your call this morning.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh, you're certainly welcome. Let me get a quick break in here so we don't get behind. Looks like I get to talk about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and what a pleasure that is. I know lots of folks, when they saw the severe storm warnings, which didn't happen fortunately, but a lot of people started worrying about those old shingle roofs because hail does beat them up, wind does beat them up. I didn't give it a second thought because I have a Southwest Metal Roofing System roof on my home, and we have the same here at Shades of Green. Their roofs are simply the best in the business. They stand up to wind, we had baseball size hail here at Shades of Green. And aside from a hard-to-find little dimple here and there, No damage whatsoever. Southwest Metal Roofing Systems simply puts on the best roof in the industry, in my opinion. A roof that will last the life of your structure. And by the way, they do new homes as well as roof replacement. So if you're building a new home, tell your builder you want Southwest Metal Roofing Systems to put the roof on. That's what we did with our groundwater district office up in Bernie, and we love the results. A roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems is very reasonably priced, and it truly is the last roof you'll ever put on your home. It'll save you money on your utility bill every month because it is so energy efficient, and many, if not most, insurance companies will give you a discount on your homeowner's insurance when you have a good metal roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. Lots and lots of reasons to get the best roof out there. Like Danny Bowes says, do it once, do it for life. It's the last roof you'll ever put on your home. Learn more by giving them a call, 210-822-6868, 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to our wonderful callers, Jan, David, and Mike. The next three callers, and Jan's up first. Good morning, Jan.
Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. Were you and Howard talking about something yesterday to patch something up like a fountain?
Yes. There is a product that is used basically to patch concrete, whether it's a fountain or, you know, a water trough or something like that. And it's called Pond, P-O-N-D, Pond Shield, S-H-I-E-L-D. It's an epoxy type product where you mix two different things together, and I just put it on with like a tongue depressor or something like that, and it hardens. And I've used it on probably 100-year-old concrete pond in my front yard, and gosh, we did it on a couple of bird baths and things like that. It really, really does work well. It's a little bit of a mess to use, and you only want to make up a small amount so you don't waste it. But, yeah, it's called Pond Shield, and it's designed for concrete. I don't know how it would work on other surfaces.
Yeah, this is resin, so I'm not sure either.
Yeah, and I think we might still have a box around. I'll have to go read and see. I got it out at Water Garden Gym, so you might call over there and ask them, and they can tell you what it will and will not work on.
Okay. I have a large pot that I want to do a spiller.
Uh-huh.
But it's in really hot sun this summer, so what would work in there?
Oh, golly. Right now you could use something like Salvia greggii, which blooms all summer and loves it hot and bright. excuse me. Something in my throat this morning. It's early for periwinkles, but you know, a couple of weeks from now, if it continues to warm up, periwinkles would be absolutely beautiful to plant in with it. You could plant, golly, there's so many different things. Lantana could be beautiful in that pot. We're just getting into the season for bougainvilleas and other tropical plants, that would do really well. Things that will grow and bloom up until it gets really hot would be things like petunias that will grow and trail to some extent. But if you want to do it once and, you know, have it good for the whole summer, you could plant bougainvilleas. Plant them now. They are available. You could plant, golly, there are just so many things. The little compact Esperanza is something that blooms all summer long and loves it just really hot and bright. Other pretty annuals, you could plant copper plants, you could plant asparagus springeri. You can get your three different your three different ingredients, so to speak, in a lot of different forms, but those are just a few of the things that are perfectly happy where you have full blazing west sun.
Okay. I did buy one plant, and I'm going to have to spell it for you because I don't know how to say it.
Okay.
It's S-C-A-E-V-E-L-A.
Scaevola. It's also known as, it's a Brazilian plant. It's a pretty plant. It would be happiest with morning sun and afternoon shade. But it will grow in full sun. The common name of it is fan flower. That's a little easier to say than scaevola, yeah. but there's several different colors of it, and it would tolerate that sun, but I would prefer to put that particular plant where it gets like strong morning sun, but just a little protection from that atrocious sun that we get in July and August.
Yeah, last year this pot sits in a flower bed too, and I had now the name's not coming to me. Anyway, they grow the stalk and have the Hawaiian flowers on them. What are they called?
There are, there are a bunch of.
I have plumerias out there, and they did pretty good, but I haven't planted them out.
Yeah, plumerias, you just have to give them good winter protection, or they will just turn to mush. But something like your salvia.
We pulled them out of the ground and brought them in.
And isn't that funny? You can leave them even totally out of the soil. A lot of people just hang them up in the garage and then replant them the next spring, and they do fine. But that's fine. That's just a little extra work. But if you plant something like the salvia greggii, the lantana, the pink skullcap, those are all things that, unless we have one of these single-digit winters, those can stay out all the time and come back year after year. I still love tropical things, Hawaiian or Caribbean or whatever else, and that's the reason I like the compact Esperanzas. Most of your hibiscus don't want it quite that bright, but there is a variegated one that takes the sun really well. The only color I had ever seen till yesterday was a red, but yesterday there's a new one out that's sort of a peach-colored one. It has kind of unusual flowers, but that variegated green and white foliage, and the more sun it gets, the more purple, the more anthocyanin develops in it, and it's beautiful foliage with, hibiscus flowers as well, so it's a pretty thing to put in a pot.
Okay. Yeah, I had some things in there last year, and it didn't do so well. I had, like, the potato vine. Mm-hmm. It just didn't like how hot, and it's a ceramic pot. It's not one of those resin pots.
Right.
Big old thing.
Potato vine will take the hot sun, but it's very, very thirsty. In fact, probably the prettiest bed I've ever seen of the variegated potato vine was up in the Dallas Botanical Garden on a west-facing slope where it just could not have been any hotter or brighter, but I think they were watering it every day, maybe even twice a day to keep it going.
Does that span flower grow like a shrub?
Oh, no. It actually is going to kind of trail. We see it frequently grown in hanging baskets because it sort of spills over the edge and hangs down. It would be pretty planted at the edge of a pot, but it grows out and down rather than up.
Okay, that's okay. That's good. Okay, well, I guess you've helped me out this morning, so I appreciate it.
That's what I'm here for, Jan, and I always enjoy hearing from you. You get out and have a great Sunday.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. David's next in line. Good morning, David. Are you with us, David? Didn't actually hit the mute button, did you? Don, I'm not hearing David. Are you hearing David on the line? I hear something there. David, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Bob?
I'm good, doing well. How about yourself?
Well, I'm doing better now that I can talk to you. listen, got a problem with Russian thistles, bunches of them.
Yep.
What can I spray on Russian thistle that's not going to kill the grass that's around it?
Not much. Russian thistle, about the only thing to do is to cut it off or mow it off. It's a weird plant. It's cyclical. Some years you can have a ton of seed and have very few plants sprout the next spring. Other years it seems like every seed out there sprouts. And this is one of those years. It's going to be a real issue. I was weed eating and, looking out in my fields, and I'm seeing probably 100 times more than I dealt with all of last year. And the bad news about that stuff is when it gets up to, even close to having the flowers open, that seed is already mature enough. Even if you cut it off, it'll go ahead and make some viable seeds. So what I do with it, and I was doing this just the day before yesterday, is lop the top off and put it in a burn pile or something like that, and then just mow down the base. If you can cut it off below ground level, you'll kill it pretty effectively, but it's there's not much of anything out there that'll kill it once it gets up and growing. As far as sprays, even the toxic stuff doesn't knock it back completely, and it'll just devastate your grass and things. So where you have, you know, just small plants coming up, you might hit it with a little vinegar and orange oil and just try to keep it off your grass, because it won't kill your grass. It'll just discolor it. But if they're of any size at all, I just carry a grubbing hoe out there and try to chop it off half an inch below ground level, and then it rarely ever comes back after you do that.
Well, we'll have to give that a shot. We've been doing that for years, but hopefully there was something a little bit easier.
I wish it was, but, you know, the good news is the weather this year has been just about perfect for wildflowers. The bad news is that Russian thistle thinks it's a wildflower, and it's just thriving out there this year. But
yeah, as far as wildflowers go, I didn't plant a single bluebonnet seed this year. I have over the many years in the past. This year I didn't plant a single bluebonnet, and they're just thicker than thick in my raised bed.
Yeah, isn't that fun? You didn't plant a one, and yet they're prettier than they ever have been. And
I've never seen like this. Quick question. I have a pecan tree in a pot that we're going to be moving. We want to take it with us. So the pecan tree's in a pot. Is there anything I can fertilize it with, or plant food or anything?
Oh, absolutely. Get some of Medina's Hastagrow or the Medina Liquid Fish Blend. Pecan tree will love that. When you do get to your destination and want to put it in the ground, when you take it out of the pot, just go down one side of the root ball with a sheetrock knife or something like that. Just slice down maybe half an inch into the soil ball and cut any root that's, you know, trying to go round and around that way. Would be even better if you did it on each side of the root ball. That will prevent long-term problems with girdling roots. And any, you know, pecans are, they're hard to keep in a pot unless you have one of those special, narrow, very deep pots for it. But as a result, they frequently wind up with girdling roots that long-term is not good, because your pecan tree is going to make a big underground structure. It's not really a taproot, but it goes down like a taproot, and you sure don't want other roots wrapping around that and strangling it.
Okay, so it has to grow in the fish emulsion?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
and then when you get ready to plant, like I say, just slip it out of its pot and slice down each side, you know, with a strong-bladed knife or something like that, about half an inch into the root ball, and you'll be setting that pecan tree up for, you know, 400 years of life or so.
Sounds great. Hey, listen, I appreciate your time this morning. Have a blessed day.
You do the same, David. Thank you for the call. All right, let's get a quick break in here. Mike, you'll be up next, but right now, looks like I get to talk about Wild Birds Unlimited. And once again, a subject that I absolutely love, because I love that store. It's not just a bird store. It's a nature store, and it's a gift shop all in one. Sure, they have everything you need for birds, and they want to remind you hummingbirds are arriving, so get a good feeder. One that has a little built-in ant stopper, so you don't get the ants trying to get in there. Even since we don't have a lot of hummingbirds yet, they have something you can add to the nectar that will extend the life, so you're not out there trying to change it so often. Now, hopefully, a little later in the summer, you'll have so many hummers you're having to refill them every day or two anyway. But in the meantime, Wild Birds Unlimited has things to help you do better. They also have the seed blends and the suet cake. They're going to help the other songbirds now. They're starting to raise nests this spring. Still hoping for purple martins? Well, Wild Birds Unlimited has martin houses and poles. They have just about everything you could want for the birder. But they also have some nature-related things that your kids would love. And a wonderful gift store. They always have beautiful things in there to improve your garden. Sun catchers, wind chimes, beautiful fountains, and bird baths. Wild Birds Unlimited is a great place to visit. It's where I do a lot of gift shopping, I'll tell you. Out there in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner, kind of faces the Northwest Military side. From the distance, you'll say, oh, that's not a very big place. You walk through the door and you say, wow, how did Kyle get so many neat things in there? And they wanted me to tell you that in a few weeks, there's also going to be a Wild Birds Unlimited up on the north end of Burney. So if you're up in that area, you won't have to drive all the way into San Antonio to find all those Wild Birds products. Wild Birds Unlimited, if you have any questions, give them a call, 479-BIRD, 479-BIRD, for Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. I know you were getting a busy signal there for a while, but Don tells me that we've got a bunch of lines open now. Mike's going to be up next, but you can probably get right through if you dial 210-599-5555. While I say good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
I just have a few questions.
That's what I'm here for.
The first one, I have a Texas persimmon tree. It's still a baby. It's only a couple feet high. It's in a container still. Anyways, it seems to be doing great. But my question is, on a few of the leaves, I've noticed it has what look like warts. They're like little bubbled up sections. And when you look underneath the leaf, it's got like some white cottony material. Do you know what that is?
It's a harmless little gall. Probably it's either caused by an insect or by a weird bacteria, but it is totally harmless to the tree and nothing to worry about.
Okay, thanks. Then next question, I have a dwarf fig tree. It's also a couple feet tall in a little container, and it also seems to be doing great. But on the edges of some of the leaves, it has that stuff that looks like rust.
Yeah.
What is that?
That's just getting a little too dry at some point. And also, these are last year's leaves that are still on the tree.
Yes, I took it inside when it froze and all that.
Yeah, it's figs. Figs do not. I mean, they're one of the hardiest things out there, but they do not like to ever get dry. They have a very shallow root system, and if they get even a little too dry, that's just their normal stress response. And that fig in nature would be outside where it would drop all its leaves every winter anyway, and they would be replaced by beautiful new leaves. You just kept the old leaves around by protecting it from the cold. In the future, I would only bring it in if it's going to be really severely cold, down to into the low 20s. I wouldn't worry about it. But is this Little Miss Figgy, or do you know which variety it is?
It's not. It's that patio fruit brand. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
And it just says hardy fig on the tag.
Yeah. it'll give you a lot of figs. They won't be enormous, but it is basically an ever-bearing fig. So you should be able to pick from it all summer long. And I don't encourage repotting in most cases because there are more plants killed by repotting plants when they didn't really need it than any other problem. But figs have a very expansive root system. They need plenty of moisture, and if it's drying out quickly, if it seems to be drying out every day, I'd think about moving it into a pot that's about 2 or 3 inches larger in diameter than what it's growing in right now.
I actually did just pot it. It was in about a 3 gallon, and I put it in a 10 gallon, and it really did have it seemed pretty root bound at the bottom of that 3 gallon pot.
Well, you're fine then. You're good for another couple of years, or unless you decide to put it in the ground.
Okay, great. And then my last question, I have a couple varieties of peaches and a couple varieties of pears. They've been in the ground about 2 years. If I wanted to try and self-pollinate those, what do I do? I think I've heard you talk about it. You just dust a little artist paintbrush around in the flowers?
That's exactly right. With some other types of fruit, the male and female parts of the flower, the pollen or the stamen and the pistil are not ready at the same time, so to speak. And that's what Mother Nature did to mean it had to be cross-pollinated from another separate tree. And that genetically improves the tree. But peaches and pears are both what we call monoecious. You can certainly... self-pollinating will give you good fruit, and if you're not seeing a lot of bees or flies or things like that, just get out there with your little mini paintbrush and just dust around inside, and you should help with fruit set by a large degree.
Okay, and then should I go between the varieties, like from the one peach to the other variety of peach with the brush, or?
That would be even better, but considering that you're not really going to use these peaches to make seed to raise more trees, it doesn't really matter. Self-pollination is going to give you just as good fruit. So do whatever's convenient to you. But if you've got any kids or grandkids or somebody like that, like I think I planted a peach pit when I was about 5 years old, and My family actually lived in that house long enough to see it produce, and it's fun. It's fun to, you know, plant a seed and have it grow and not know exactly what it's going to produce. But unless you're going to be in the same place for the next 6 or 8 years, it'll seem like a long, long time. So I wouldn't worry about it if it were my tree.
Okay, and then I can do that as soon as the flower opens up, or is there a certain time period you got to do it?
If you, what you could do is you could take something like a Q-tip and get out there and just kind of rub it around. If you see pollen, you know, little yellow stain, so to speak, on the end, you will know that that flower is mature enough to be pollinated.
Okay.
Until that pollen begins to shed, no, it's not mature enough to do its job of, you know, fertilizing the female part of the flower, but for that matter, you can just take your index finger and rub it around in there, and if you come up with a little bit of yellow-looking stuff on your finger, you'll know that, that's ready to be pollinated.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Mike. Thank you for the call this morning. Let's see here. Yeah, I think we can squeeze Nancy in here before the break. Good morning, Nancy.
Yeah, Bob, I have two quick questions. The first one is, I have a Spanish dagger yucca that was in a pot for a long time, and I put it inside during the wintertime. And last year, I guess I covered it more. I didn't really cover it this year. It was established, and it is, the stalk is totally, you know, hollow. Is there any chance it'll grow back? Should I cut it off, or just
if it? If it is a true yucca, it will probably come back from the base. Now, that's the problem with common names. What I know as Spanish dagger is a totally cold-hardy yucca. What you have is probably one of them they call, well, its name is Yucca elephantiipes, and it is not cold-hardy. But yuccas, unlike many other plants, do have the potential to branch out at the base. So it probably will come back for you. I wouldn't give up on it. And if you decide to plant another one, I definitely would not plant that same variety, because they grow that as a landscape plant down in the Rio Grande Valley. But up here, it's going to freeze back more years than not.
Okay. So do I cut the stalk off? Or
might
do
as well.
Like that
might as well. If it's hollow and, you know, compresses with your finger, carefully cut it back without snapping it off at ground level.
Okay, and another question. I have a Texas primrose. I guess it's called a mangave.
Okay.
It's irrigated, and it's in a pot. What is the best way to care for that?
It needs full sun, wants to get fairly dry between waterings. It's an odd hybrid. It's a combination between something called a manfreda, which is a weird desert plant, and an agave, and that's where the name mangave comes from. It's kind of an odd thing. I mean, I wouldn't call it a thing of great beauty, but you're probably the only person in your neighborhood that has one. But treat it like you would a yucca or an agave or something like that. Just water thoroughly when you water, but let it get fairly dry between times, and give it lots and lots of sun. It'll have odd splotches in the leaves and periodically an unusual flower spike. So it's one of the more bizarre things you could plant in the garden.
Oh, okay. And fertilize it or not?
Yeah, just give it a little has to grow or something like that. Maybe every 6 or 8 weeks. It'll get by without fertilizing, but it will be as pretty as it could possibly be, which still isn't very pretty. If you'll fertilize it periodically, it'll be much happier.
Okay. And you probably need to bring that in the winter time, because it
only if it's going to be really cold. Only if it's going to be down below 25.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bob.
You're sure welcome. Thank you for the call this morning. All right. As soon as we come back from break, Joe and Pam, right here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, let's get back to gardening. And, it's just a beautiful Sunday morning out there. After a good rain overnight, just an ideal weekend, I tell you what. Looks like my next three callers are going to be Joe and Pam and Angie. Joe is first in line. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Bob. How are you today?
off to a good start. You know, not a whole lot more, as my partner's husband used to say, the place where a new calf and a good rain are always welcome. Well, we got the good rain last night, and I had a new calf earlier this week, so life is good.
There you go. Go buy a lottery ticket.
That's an optimistic view.
It's been a while since I called, but I always appreciate the information you share. I have a couple of questions. They all revolve around St. Augustine. My mom has about 22 oak trees on her property, and they've all dropped their leaves, picked up most of the leaves, but in her mind, there's still a lot of leaves on the ground, and she's reading that they're very acidic, and so she had to pick up all of them.
No. It's if anything's acidic, it's going to be pecan leaves and walnut leaves, and it would be a benefit if they were acidic, because our soils are so alkaline, a little acid would help free up some of the natural nutrients that are in the soil. But no, oak leaves, my strongest suggestion would be, if you can, just run through them with a lawnmower, chop them up in little smaller pieces so they don't blow away. And this is how Mother Nature's been building soil for thousands and thousands of years. So I'm not trying to just get you off the hook, but it's the tassels too that are going to be coming down, that are forming their little reproductive structure prior to the acorns. Those are also high in protein, and they are in effect fertilizing the tree. So like I say, all I would do is I would run the mower through the leaves to chop them up, but absolutely do not bag and put those out for the garbage, man. That's a waste of a very valuable nutrient and takes up landfill space. It's getting more and more expensive. So tell her you got a note from the teacher that says you don't have to rake the leaves.
Yeah. She might be listening this morning. I shared with your show with her, and I share it with many people.
Well, I appreciate that.
My pleasure. So the next question kind of ties into that. I know composting is really good. It seems like many years ago you might have referred or mentioned Gardenville. I've used their compost before, but is there something here in the local San Antonio area that you'd recommend?
Well, Gardenville, you see, saws has a lot of waste to get rid of, what are called biosolids, and they're actually paying some companies out there to take the biosolids off their hands, and consequently, I think most all the Gardenville products now are biosolids based. Unfortunately, I don't know if New Earth is still making a manure-based compost. I think they've gone largely to biosolids, and I just don't like biosolids. It's not that it's human waste. That doesn't bother me. As Malcolm used to say, you know, humans have been using that for a long, long time. But today's waste stream is so loaded up with pharmaceuticals. It's loaded up with all sorts of chemical products, in some cases pesticides. All this stuff goes down through the sanitary sewer system, and it's just not something I want to put on my lawn or in my garden. I think it's fine. Agricultural fields, yeah, it'd be a good thing to do with it. But and it's getting harder to find good compost without biosolids. There's a company out west of San Antonio toward Castroville that, you know, makes some very, very good compost. It's called Landscape Solutions and Nursery, I believe. There's one I understand. I haven't visited them, but a man I trust very much. I sent out there and came away very happy with the compost he got. And I think it's called Blanco Materials or something. It's out on Blanco Road between 1604 and 46 out that way. But wherever you look for it, if it were mine, I simply would ask for either a manure-based or an alfalfa-based compost product as opposed to biosolids.
Okay, so manure-based. Okay, so that's fair enough. Yeah, I recognize that they had moved to biosolids. So, I'm central San Antonio, so I guess there's a few options.
I wish somebody would get after this. And some people don't object. You know, that's simply your choice to make. But if you ask me what I'm going to put in my garden or what I'm going to put on my yard, I mean, I'm concerned. I love my dogs and cats as well as I like most people. And they're running around barefoot out there, so I'm not going to put anything on the yard that I wouldn't run around barefoot in.
Okay. All right, thank you. And then my last one is, and I've taken some pictures to your shop before. I've got about a 25 by 25 yard, so very small. A huge crepe myrtle, about 25 feet tall, and also a huge oak tree on the side of the house that pretty much consumes most of the yard. So there is a lot of shade, and I try to kind of keep it thinned out. But I've replaced, it seems like half of the St. Augustine stays alive. I know it was very dormant, and it turned very, it didn't even turn brown. It seems like the grass just kind of dissipated, and you just saw the roots. But in this, there's one area that seems to keep dying, and I just replaced half of it last year with some compost and some also some new St. Augustine, and it seems like it's just more than not dormant. And I seemed like I thought I watered enough. So, any tips or things that you might recommend?
Well, so much of this area. If you could use, you know, what is the new ground-penetrating radar kind of stuff, you would probably find that there are areas where you either have caliche domes that come up very close to the surface, or you have rock that is very close to the surface. I know in a home I used to live in, I'd get up on the roof. I certainly wouldn't do that in my roof that's now 35 feet tall. But you could look down at the yard, and you could pick out, you know, where you had big rocks under the surface or where you had a caliche dome, because it'd go from dark green to lighter green to yellow back to dark green. And when there's just one particular area where you can't get things to grow, I'm always suspicious that there's something about the soil. I know Howard Garrett probably has broken a few golf clubs in his life, and he takes an old golf club and, you know, saws it off at an angle and uses that to probe down into the soil and find out what's down below the surface of the soil. And my suspicion is you just have an area where you have very, very thin soil over something not so good underneath it. If the yard is that small, I would even think about going at least in part of it to a ground cover like Asian jasmine or something like that, or dwarf monkey grass grows well in the shade. Vinca major, very fast growing along with Vinca minor. It may be a time that, you know, everybody should have a little bit of grass for kids and pets and things, but ground covers take a whole lot less water and a whole lot less maintenance. And you do indeed have, you know, 625 square feet is not a very big area. And you might want to think about something other than just, you know, fence-to-fence grass.
Okay.
And if you do want to go with St. Augustine, be sure you're getting the right variety. The only two St. Augustines, I mean, all St. Augustine is more shade-tolerant than Bermuda, but Palmetto and Del Mar are the two varieties that are most shade-resistant. But there's such a thing as, you know, too much shade even for St. Augustine.
Okay. I appreciate your help as always, and thanks for everything that you do.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing out there, and call me anytime, Joe. Always good to hear from you.
All right. Have a good day. Thank you.
You too. Bye. All right. Let me go and get a quick break out of here so I don't have to rush Pam or Angie. Looks like I get to talk about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and this is the second day of their Medina weekend, you might say. There's some folks from Medina there. I suspect it's my friend Andy Chidester, who is one wonderful lady. But Fanix is doing 20% off all the Medina products yesterday and today. Plus, you've got the expert from Medina there to answer any questions you might have. And pretty much all day, I believe, you can call Fanix and get the, or actually go on their website at fanixnursery.com. to get all the complete details, but like I say, 20% off all the Medina products today. Plus, Fanix is well stocked on potatoes, seed potatoes, and onions, and all the veggies you want for spring, the peppers and eggplant and tomatoes. At one point, they had like 25 varieties of tomatoes. They also well stocked on trees, both fruit trees and citrus and shade trees, plants that qualify for the SAWS Water Saver Rebate Program. Plus, they've got some new things in that Ego lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. My copy from Mike says they even have a riding mower that's battery-powered. I got to go check that out sometime. Anyway, Fanix, right where they've been for 85 years, over on Home Green Road. Always a good place to visit. Always lots of fun stuff. And be a lot of fun to get over and visit with the good folks from Medina today. So if you're in that neighborhood, go by and say hello. Check out all the events at Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Looks like it's going to be Pam and Angie and Robert. Pam is first in line. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I am from the New Braunfels area, and I have two trees that I'm still worried about. We had that freeze, what was it, 21? I mean, I lost
right.
one really big tree. And then I've got two trees that still lose bark.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what kind of tree they are. The other trees in the yard seem to be okay, but these, I mean, like they've lose big, long pieces of bark off branches and off the trunk and everything. Is there, does that sound like something you heard of? Is there something I can do?
What does the foliage look like on the trees? How do the leaves look? And have they started coming out this spring?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the trees look great, except the bark keeps falling off.
Well, that may be a natural thing. Some trees, you know, actually, it's called exfoliating their bark. Crepe myrtles do this all the time. The most common tree that, you know, just loses a lot of bark, and the wood underneath is almost white, but sycamore, both Mexican sycamore and American sycamore, you know, shed bark constantly, and it's not a sign of a problem at all. Tell me about the leaves on the tree. Are they big, broad leaves? Are they little, tiny, narrow leaves? What do the leaves look like?
They're more narrow. I'm sorry, I don't know trees. I know they're not oaks. They're not crepe myrtle. That's about all I can tell
okay.
you. They're narrower leaves. They're not big like big oaks or maples or anything. They're that the extent of my knowledge on trees. My concern was that they didn't used to do this before that freeze we had.
Well. How big in diameter are the trunks of these trees?
One of them is about a foot and a half across, and the other one's
okay.
probably about a foot. They're mature trees.
Yeah, but some trees don't really start. You have to realize that bark is basically dead tissue. Bark is something, you know, it's kind of like you. Every now and then you kind of slough off a layer of skin and produce more to the inside, and trees do exactly the same thing. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, and if the trees look good as far as producing, you know, healthy, nice leaves that, you know, stay on for most of the year, that tells me that the trees probably are not in bad shape at all. So take a picture, take a little piece of bark, whatever, by a good nursery, and ask them to take a look at it, because I'm not at all sure there's anything wrong with the trees. This may just be a natural exfoliation of the bark, and as long as the tree appears healthy, as long as the root flare's exposed, you know, all things being equal, I wouldn't worry too much.
Okay, well, if you don't think you'd worry, I won't either.
I tell you what you can do. Really nice guy, and I don't think he'll charge anything for it, but probably the best arborist I know used to work for the best arborist company I've ever known, Inter Tree Care, but David Vaughn, he's the fellow that teaches the courses that other arborists have to take if they want to get certified. Google Vaughn Arbor Care. If you don't find it, call me back and I'll give you his number. But, call him and tell him what's happening. He's probably going to tell you to send him a picture, and you know he'll give you an answer to it. If it's to the point that you would actually like to pay somebody to come take a look at it, David has nothing to sell you except some time. I mean, he said once he got to a certain age, he said, I don't have to work as hard as an arborist does at trimming and everything else. So he's not going to sell you something you don't need, but heck of a nice guy. And chances are, if you send him a picture, he'll just call you and say, hey, don't worry, or he might say, well, you need to do this, that, or the other. But from what you're describing to me, I'm not hearing anything that's going to cause me great concern at all. These are big trees. If they're producing good, healthy foliage, and obviously you're doing well, I don't think you have anything to worry about.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the help and enjoy listening to you every day, every weekend, for sure.
Well, I appreciate that, Pam. You get out and have a wonderful St. Paddy's Day today.
Well, I'm wearing my green. You too.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. I believe Angie's next in line. Good morning, Angie.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question on how long to soak for corn water tea. I bought it soaking now, and I want to know how long to soak before I spray.
Overnight. If you put it in this morning, you could use it this evening or use it tomorrow morning. But I'm going to say 8 to 10 hours minimum. And if you're able to plan, you know, a day in advance, just soak it the night before and it'll be ready to go the next morning.
Okay, good to know. I'm just making sure. I was going to spray my fruit trees with their second spray, and their flowers all fell off, and Howard says to spray them again. So I said, I'll always spray them again.
Always a good idea. And I have to go back and look at DirtDoctor.com to see if he talks about this. But next time you're by a paint store, get a couple. They're just a few cents each of what they call paint strainer bags. It's what painters pour the paint through to take the lumps out of it. And what you can do is put your cornmeal in one of those bags and then just drop it down into your bucket of water overnight. And that way you don't have to strain it before you spray it. You just pull that cornmeal out and throw it under your roses or something like that. Yeah, okay, then you're way ahead.
Yeah, I got it lined in there. I use the nut bag. The milk. I told you about that once. They make these little bags with drawstrings that some people make their own almond milk.
Right.
So put it in there like a big tea bag.
Well, you're way smarter than most of us.
No, just learning by doing and listening, and I really appreciate all your help.
It's a pleasure.
Like I said, I moved here, almost 10 years ago, and this place was just stripped down in bad soil, and you should see my garden now, and I thank you for that, for all your help.
Well, it's a happy place. You've done all the work, and you deserve to take the credit, so... You call me anytime I can help you with something like that. But, no, I just would soak overnight. And if you're pouring it on to prevent oak wilt, then you don't have to worry about the bag. If you're spraying it as you're doing, you can do. And I'd forgotten, you did tell me about the little strainer bags for making almond milk and things like that. And that's a great idea. But it's of course, it's not the cornmeal that's magic. It's a trichoderma that grows on the cornmeal.
Right.
But it sure will do a lot of things to improve the health of your plants and your life as well.
One other quick thing. What determines how many corn you get on your corn stalk? Like how tall it'll get?
How tall it will get is determined by the variety of the corn. And there's some semi-dwarf corn, and then there's some of them that get really high. But you know, when you're getting ready to eat your corn, those silks that come up out of the top of the ear.
Right.
You have to have a kernel, or you have to have a pollen grain land on every one of those little silks, that's going to make a kernel of corn for you to eat. This is why we never plant corn in a long row, because corn is wind pollinated and the pollen's probably not going to cover the ears quite as well. We do several rows side by side, but the number of kernels on an ear of corn is determined by how many pollen grains landed on one of the silks that ear was producing, because that's what produces that wonderful thing, and you're making me hungry just thinking about it.
I love it. I've got it growing. Yeah, it's got my first crop in, and I noticed, you know, after it germinates, you have little spots where some didn't come up. Now, do you just have to you don't go in and fill it, because the corn won't be ready at the same time, right, if you went and put more seeds where the empty spots are?
It'll be close to the same time. I just go out with my index finger. I just punch a hole down in the ground. Of course, I like to soak your seed corn in a little bit of Garrett juice. That'll make it sprout faster. But now, while the soil is still cool, your corn's not going to be growing very quickly, and even if you plant a few more today, it'll probably catch up with the ones that are already growing. So, no, if there's spots that you want to have another plant, just stick index finger down in, drop that kernel of seed corn down in, and sit back and wait. You should be enjoying. Oh. And I don't know, have you grown corn before in this area?
Yeah, I've grown it about 5 years now.
Okay, well, then you know about possums and raccoons and squirrels and things like that would happily eat it, take it away from you. So
they don't bother my corn. I don't know what it is. I have raccoons. I have possums. But I guess there's just so much around here, they just leave my corn alone.
Knock on wood when you say that, because there's nothing much more discouraging than having an army of raccoons come in and steal every ear of corn from you. It's kind of like the come through and do the same thing and will steal every peach off of a tree. So count yourself lucky.
Yeah.
But
some reason, I don't know, I guess they share with me. They're kind of kind to me, and I appreciate their.
Well, you're very lucky.
Corn, fresh corn is like, you can't even compare it with anything you buy. It is just so amazing.
And throw it, I throw it on the grill when the pork chops are getting ready, and it's just not much of anything better. My grandfather used to take, if he had any of it that didn't store as well, he would take a sharp knife, you know, and go and cut them off and make a cream corn out of it a day or two later, and that's just almost as good as corn on the cob. So you're making me hungry just thinking about all this.
Yeah, with the ugly ones, I just do that and use it loose like that. It's so good. But anyway, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and always your help.
Always a pleasure, Angie. You get out and enjoy this beautiful Sunday morning. Goodbye.
You too. All right. Thankful for the
thank. Always a pleasure. Let's get a break in here. Robert will be up next. It looks like I get to talk to you about Rhonda's Nature's Way. Again, one of my favorite people in the world and somebody else who has helped so many people live better and live better naturally. Over 40 years now, Rhonda and her family have operated Rhonda's Nature's Way. Just one store at this point. She sort of consolidated to be able to give you better service and better staff. But Rhonda's Nature's Way is just a special, special place. If you believe, as I do, in natural nutrition and supplementation, and, you know, I take some immune-boosting supplements from Rhonda and just... Oh, like I called her recently and said, look, I'm having some, really doing a lot of work and suffering a little bit of leg cramps tonight. And she gave me something that is totally taking care of that problem. I love the product called Ultima, too. This is getting into a hot time of year. When I'm spending time outside and sweating, I mean, I learned in the desert a long time ago, you've got to keep your electrolyte level up. But I don't like salt tablets that much, and I don't like sports drinks that are full of sugar. This product I get from Rhonda that's called Ultima tastes wonderful. Gives you all the electrolytes you need, and yet no sugars, none of the stuff that'll put the pounds on. It comes in several different flavors. I'll admit my favorite is raspberry, but I've tried the lemonade and the strawberry and the grape and all the others too, and there are a lot of choices out there. But there's just a lot of good things you will find at Rhonda, plus the people who can help you choose the right thing for your lifestyle. Of course, Rhonda also does reflexology, which is an amazing art. They practice red light therapy and beamer light therapy, which your medical doctor will tell you are wonderful things. Dr. Kirby will be in here, best veterinarian I know, and he'll tell you all about the benefits of light therapy, too. Well, Rhonda does it for humans out at Rhonda's Nature's Way. Rhonda's Nature's Way closed today. Always close on Sundays and major holidays, but the other days of the week, get by and see Rhonda and her staff. They're in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. If you want to live better naturally, by all means, get by and see my friends at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening. Looks like Robert and Ron are my next two callers. That leaves a couple of open lines. Grab one of them if you like. 210-599-5555. Robert's up next. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been trying to get hold of you for a while. Okay.
Glad you made it today.
Me too. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And you as well.
My question's about asparagus. I'm starting to grow some out of a pot. Mm-hmm. How do I know if it's the edible or the fern type? And what should I be looking for? Because they're getting really tall and putting out some sort of spindly-like flower...
Well, there are
only the bottom 6 inches look like the edible type I'm used to seeing.
Yeah, there are many, many kinds of asparagus out there. A lot of them are, you know, just strictly ornamental plants like asparagus springeri, asparagus myeri, they call foxtail fern, asparagus myriocladus, they call Ming fern. But all of them, even the edible forms, if you let them grow up tall, they make that real ferny like foliage. So if yours makes stems that are, let's say, bigger in diameter than a wooden pencil, then that probably is the edible form. If it's smaller than a wooden pencil, it's probably going to be one of the ornamental ones. Now, as the plants mature, the stalks will tend to get bigger. They will tend to look more like what you get at the grocery store. But all of the edible asparagus, again, if you don't cut it when it's very young, no more than maybe 6 inches tall, it's going to grow up thin and going to make all those ferns on it. So asparagus is something that you have to harvest every day, because it goes from being something that's nice and tasty to something that's just, you know, all tiny little leaves and beyond being able to eat. So I would judge a little bit by size, but again, you don't let it get up big. You harvest it when it's no more than 6 or 8 inches tall.
These aren't much more than a month old.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'm even ready to harvest yet, but they are getting kind of tall.
Yeah, they will appear, and in a day's time, they'll grow 6 inches if it's the edible one. I mean, they just shoot up out of the ground. But it has to be a mature plant. When we first plant the plants, or crowns, as they're usually called, we don't even think about harvesting for a year, and we don't do a lot of harvesting until about the third year. And then after that, we can pick, you know, for an extended period of time. But what you might do is take a picture and take it by a good nursery or someone that knows, and it should be easy to look at it and tell you almost instantly. Or go to a good nursery and look at the ornamental asparagus ferns like springerime, foxtail, and ming, and you'll be able to tell real quickly which ones you have. If yours is the edible one, it just may be a very young plant that's just not making big spears yet. Like I say, it takes several years for them to really come into good production and make the bigger spears.
Yeah, they are very young. I just started them. I was just worried that if I needed to cut the fern parts off of them yet, or if I need to just let it go.
No,
or...
all you need to do is fertilize. Feed them once a month or so, recognizing that it's going to be, you know, probably a couple of years before you really start harvesting. But it's not like a tomato plant that you plant today, and a few weeks from now you're picking tomatoes everywhere. Asparagus is a much longer term investment. It's gonna be a while before you get the spears you're used to, the things you're used to eating. But for the next couple of years, it's just fertilize, water, and let them grow.
Okay, that's one need to know. I also have some tomato plants that they're just starting to put out tomatoes for me too.
Well, you'll be picking tomatoes a long time before you're harvesting asparagus. So focus on the tomatoes and the peppers and the eggplant and the squash and the cucumbers and the bush beans and all those other wonderful things you can harvest from the garden while your asparagus is growing.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I appreciate your knowledge, and I'll continue listening.
Well, I've made every mistake you can make in the gardening world, Robert, so I'll just try to keep you from making the same mistakes. You get out and have a great Sunday, St. Patty's Day, and we'll move along and talk to Ron. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Bob. This is Rod. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
I got a question. I've got a probably 17, 18-year-old plum tree that I put in the ground, and I have one limb out of probably 10 that is blooming out or leafing out this year.
Okay. If you have a 17-year-old plum tree, you have the equivalent of a 112-year-old person out there. And it is absolutely amazing that your plum has even lived that long. You must be a heck of a good gardener to keep it going. But I suspect all you're looking at is a very, very old tree, and maybe even a little bit, not so much winter cold, but summer drought last year probably took a toll on
all the stresses. All the stresses we've had. We've had these extreme colds over the years and the droughts and over the years and all that. So, that's pretty much what I was thinking. I just wanted to make sure that my thinking was right before I whacked this dude down and put another one in.
I mean, if you've got room to plant another one, plant it yesterday. If this one has one, if you've got one healthy limb on it, you know, you might get a good dozen good plums out of it. So I'm not sure it's time for the chainsaw.
No.
But, it's
I'm thinking I've got another one across the way that's got some root shoots on it, and I'm thinking maybe trying to pull some of these limbs off and graft them onto that and try to get those to go maybe. I don't know.
Nothing at all wrong with that.
Yeah, just for the fun of it, just to try it.
One other thing to keep in mind, Rod, is that there are some plums which are self-fertile, where you only have to have one tree. Santa Rosa is probably the most common variety there. Most plums do best with cross-pollination. So if you've had two trees and now you're down to one healthy tree, you probably need to plant another one, Methley or Bruce or Santa Rosa or something like that, to continue to get good plums. Because I see this all the time. People had a pair of plum trees, and they got good plums, then all of a sudden one of them died, and they said, my other tree's not producing any fruit at all. It's because so many varieties of plums take cross-pollination. So it might be good to plant another tree. It would be fun to go ahead and to try some grafting. But remember, if that tree that's putting out the root sprouts is very old, it's already got its own form of hardening of the arteries, so to speak. And even though you could graft it, it might not have a real good base to grow from. So it
I needed to know, because they were planted at the same time. They were planted the same year.
I think it's time for a trip over to Fanix and a couple of new trees.
Just go with new ones on both of them. I'm going to let the one is leafing out nice, so I'm going to go and definitely let it. But yeah, I was kind of thinking that, and I had a comment on compost.
Yeah,
that we get around here.
Yeah,
from my understanding from Elaine Ingham, is if you open up a compost and you let it, like a bad compost, you open that up and you come back the next day and it's covered in this white stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not good, according to Elaine.
Well,
I know it gets because Elaine is totally. Keep in mind, Elaine is totally aerobic, so there's no anaerobics allowed. And then you go to the other side where, okay, so maybe we do want some of these guys because why are they here, right? But if you're opening up a bag of compost and you let it sit overnight and it's covered in white. That's totally anaerobic. I mean not totally, but I mean it's pretty much anaerobic. And so what I'm getting at is we might ought to be taking these compost and trying to finish them. Is what I'm thinking. If we're going to buy the bad compost, because if nothing else, whether you agree or disagree that it's anaerobic or not anaerobic is good or bad. Mm-hmm. It's still not finished if it's doing that. It's not done cooking, right?
And you're absolutely right about that. And do you know Dr. Ingham? Have you ever met her?
Yeah, I met her at the that compost tea conference years ago, back with Malcolm Beck. I mean, this has been I took the soil food web course. I didn't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I didn't do that great, but I completed it, passed. But I know a little bit about Elaine.
The main thing about the ones that you're describing is that they basically waterproof and airproof the soil. They're just too dense up on the surface, and that's why it's far better to buy bulk compost where it's not sitting around in a bag. And it concerns me, even though sometimes it's all we can get. You don't know how long that bag's been sitting on a parking lot somewhere in that bag. And as we learned from Elaine, only about half of the microbes in there have a resting state. So you've already lost. But there's so many different things out there. But I'm with you. You'll never have anything too well aerified. And, if you've got the time and the place, finish them, maybe even adding a little bit of molasses to, kick up the biological activity to finish them more quickly. That is by far the best way to go, especially if you're going to use that compost to make compost tea or something like that. But
We'll buy a better compost. We used to use the ladybug for compost teas, but that's not really around so much anymore. So now I'm getting stuff out of Oregon or Washington, some of your other biodynamic compost and stuff. To make compost teas, or just using the stuff that I make here, because I guarantee the compost that I got here is probably it's the best in my yard. I'll guarantee you, it's been cooking back there for 10-15 years. I've had that pile going, so it's going.
And of course, the only advantage you get from going with a professional company, so to speak, is that they've got a greater diversity of feedstocks going into it. That's back when Clayton Leonard was newer.
I guarantee you not putting more in it than I'm putting in it.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about what you typically buy in a bag.
Because they're limited. They're using whatever they're buying or whatever they're being paid now to get rid of,
and that's their stock. And then the other thing is that they're not taking the time to finish it, even in your bigger areas. I mean, Malcolm, even back in the day, 15, 20 years ago at that compost tea conference, I mean, Elaine got Malcolm, you know, going, he was stirring up his stuff, and it had that horrible smell, and she said, that's anaerobic.
Right.
And you're like, huh? Yeah. And this was a massive pile.
I know.
Yeah, but he was apparently turned at that one, apparently hadn't been turned soon enough. Let's just say that.
and Malcolm, you know, Malcolm didn't know it all, but he learned from his mistakes. I'll put it that way.
Oh, well,
but
he was learning from Elaine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing at that conference. I didn't hang out with Elaine. I hung out with Malcolm the whole time.
and Bruce. Right. Ron, I got to let you go to do a commercial here. I appreciate the call. Get out and plant those plums, and we'll talk again. Right now, it looks like I get to talk to you once again about azomite. And, again, it just, you know, I'm so glad to see azomite on the market now. I first was introduced to it several years ago at a trade show, actually, up in San Marcos, and was absolutely amazed to learn all the different things that are in it. Well, now it's available in just about every nursery out there, and still the great, great material, or that comes out of somewhere either in Oregon or Arizona or Nevada up that way. But it's a natural product. It's not synthetic. There's nothing man-made in it. It is full of close to 100 different micronutrients and compounds in there to benefit plant growth. And it's totally non-toxic. It will never burn. It is put on as a dry granular material, or you can get it micronized, a very, very fine powder that can be suspended in water and sprayed. But I've not ever found anything that greens things up better or provides a broader range of micronutrients all in one product. You'll find it at fine nurseries and garden centers. Like I say, you make your choice. Get the finely powdered and spray it on, or get the more granular form and just sprinkle it on. It doesn't have to be watered in, but doesn't really go to work until it gets some moisture. But again, nothing you'll ever have to worry about burning. A lot of people blend it into their potting soils. I use it in the vegetable garden, flower beds, even in pots where I have things that are a little yellowing, like periwinkles sometimes do in the summer. Azomite is just a wonderful product, and it does an awful lot to prevent. And if you have problems, it will even correct many different problems for you. Look forward to your good nursery or garden centers. Wherever fine products are sold, you will find azomite, A-Z-O-M-I-T-E.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Oh, this is crazy. My partner just texted from up in the Bergheim, Kendalia area. They're getting hail up there, up to quarter-size hail right now. So maybe this little storm system hasn't totally moved through like we thought it had. Let's see here. We're going to get back to the phone lines, and it looks like it's Robert, Clint, and Susie. Robert's first in line. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. Let me get out this Bluetooth.
Yes, sir.
Still there?
I'm right here. Are you still there? Don Robert might have cut himself off. Okay. Well, let's go right on and visit with Clint then. Robert, call back. We'll talk in a moment. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning. How's it going?
It's going along. Kind of a crazy night if it's still hailing in the hill country, but some folks got a good rain. Looked like a little of it was south of San Antonio. Hope you got some.
I got an inch.
Oh, good for you.
Just in time for the coastal to start kicking in, so that's good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What's going on today?
I got back in that freeze. I think it's called a tree of heaven. Yeah, does that sound right or familiar?
Again, that's a problem with common names. Pink flowers, what does it look like?
Yellow flowers that the bees absolutely love.
Okay, yeah, I'm not sure which one that is. It's one of those ones out of the Caribbean, if I remember correctly, but I couldn't tell you the botanical name of it. It's we can probably Google it and find out. What's the question about it?
Well, the freeze almost killed it. Some of the trunks I thought were dead, and you can see the bark starting to fall off of it. But yet there were some sprouts coming off that half-dead limb. Is that safe enough to allow it to keep growing, or should it just come on down?
Well, if you've got new growth coming out from the base, and that's like lots of tropical plants, lots of Caribbean plants, they just aren't real cold hardy, and I would never want to take all the green foliage off at one time. If it is producing some foliage up on largely dead limbs and some foliage from the base, yeah, I probably would cut those limbs off and force it to come out where it's got a little bit healthier wood to grow from. But if there's no new growth down at the base, you pretty much have to leave, for now at least, you have to leave the leaves that are there, just because that tree's got to be able to photosynthesize to stay alive for any length of time.
Yeah, well, nothing's coming off at the base. It's just some of the partial dead limbs where they're starting to resprout and got new growth on. I just don't know if that's going to be safe enough and that limb be strong enough to support anything else.
Long term, I would say probably no. It sounds kind of like our Hong Kong orchid tree. You know, after we have cold winters, we have to cut it way back, but it comes back out so quickly that, you know, it's in a year's time, it's back up to a 12 or 15 foot tree. And I think your tree of heaven's going to be the same way. I might wait a week or two and see how much those limbs, and if the growth, you know, if the healthy looking growth that's coming out is down toward the trunk or down toward a big limb, probably worth saving. If it's coming out way out on the end of a mostly dead limb, I'd probably go ahead and cut that limb off and force the tree to put its energy into something that long-term is going to be stronger.
Okay, and it's kind of the same thing with the crepe myrtle, but it wasn't a freeze-related. It just started coming back up out of the ground from the roots, and it's a whole bunch of multiple little branches. Is it best to minimize that down to one or leave it coming out as a bush?
That's up to you. Crepe myrtles are not grafted. They're grown from cutting, so it's up to you. If you want a big bush, just, you know, let it come out as is. If you want a multi-trunk tree, which is how I think crepe myrtles are prettiest, but that's just my opinion, then I would thin it out to the strongest four or five things coming up and let those grow. But that's strictly up to you. It's going to bloom just as well whether it's a tree or a bush. A bush is not nearly so susceptible to storm damage, so that's how I personally like to see them grown, as a multi-trunk bush or a multi-trunk tree, however you look at it.
Okay, and I guess the last one I got is Floritan identification. One website says it has some purple in it. Some of them say it looks just like regular carpet grass, other a little bit wider. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, all of St. Augustine's will have a little bit of anthocyan and the purple pigment in them. Floritam is just a coarser grass. The runners will be slightly larger. The leaves will be slightly broader. It's not nearly as soft to step on, but it's, I think, mostly is going to be in the size and the texture of the leaves. If you want to hang on for a minute, we can talk more. I've got to go to news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, let's get back to gardening here, and I guess we got Clint's problems mostly answered. Looks like Susie and David are my next two callers, and I just hate to keep people waiting, so right on back to the phone line. Susie's first in line. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have kind of three little questions. We planted three cherry laurels last year in April, and of course they struggled this summer. So they've come out, they bloomed, and now the leaves are turning yellow. Is this a water issue?
Whereabouts do you live?
Chavanoe. We're on a rock.
I know. And that's what the biggest problem is. Cherry laurels in deep soil are good plants. There's that little one they call Brighton Tide. There's one my grandfather had in his yard in Dallas. It was 30 feet tall. But your biggest issue is lack of soil. It's not, it may be a little bit due to water, but they simply don't like that rock and caliche mix, which is what Chavanoe Park is known for.
Yeah.
I would feed, I would mulch, I would use some of the azomite around it. In fact, I'd be adding azomite to them probably every 6 months. But,
okay.
Yeah, if we had talked beforehand, I'm afraid I wouldn't have recommended cherry laurel for that area. Is it the big one or is it the little bright and tight compact
it's
one?
It's bright and tight.
Well, that's better because it's not going to try to put its roots as far out. But, you know, I would get some living mulch, actually, and I'd probably mulch those things heavily at least 3 feet out in all directions, you know, from the trunk of the tree. Feed regularly, probably with the liquid has to grow because that's the fastest one that'll be used most quickly. But I'd be using, how tall are the plants now?
Probably 5 feet.
Yeah, I'd be putting a couple of cups of azomite around them every 6 months. And like I say, the azomite is the one thing I've ever found that will take leaves that are already yellow and help get them back to a green color. Most things, you know, you're waiting for it to put on some new foliage. But if the azomite doesn't help them, there's not much of anything I know of that will.
Okay. Well, we don't want to do that. All right, next question. I have a little volunteer mountain laurel that has come up in the backyard. It's probably 4.5 feet.
Okay.
Is it possible to transplant that, or it's in a location where I can't leave it?
Yeah. It's if you can't leave it, you can try, but mountain laurels are without doubt the hardest trees I've ever known to try to transplant. And here's part of the reason. You know, if that mountain laurel were growing in deep soil, it would have a lot of its growth right at the very base of the plant. And you could dig a reasonable size root ball and hope to get enough of the root system that it would survive transplanting. When you're sitting on a shelf of rock, that even at 4 feet tall, that tree's probably got roots halfway to the neighbor's property because it's reaching out so far to try to find a place to grow. And when you dig that same size root ball, instead of getting 60% of the roots, you're getting 6% of the roots. And there's just, I don't want to give you false hope. There is very little hope of transplanting it successfully. Now, it doesn't mean that if you were able to leave it there, it wouldn't grow well. I was, you know, kind of wandering around parts of my ranch that I haven't seen in a while. And I have an area of a hillside that probably doesn't have a half an inch of soil on it. And it is a field of mountain laurels. They've probably been there 50 years, and they're all of about 12 to 18 inches tall. They grow, they bloom. But they're just these poor, stunted little dwarf trees because they have no soil to to grow in, but they're healthy plants, and they've been there forever, but they've probably got roots all the way over to Bandera. But if there's any way you can leave it, do so. If not, you can try transplanting it, but don't feel like you're a failure if it doesn't make it, because even even the best of the best probably couldn't transplant that tree successfully.
Yeah, this is right at the back door to the garage, and it's in the way as you come and go. And it's off the back porch, so we probably have 4 or 5 feet of dirt because we had to build up. So that's probably why it's doing well. But I don't think we're going to be able to make that work.
Cut a new hole in the garage. Cut a new hole in the garage and put a different door in it. That tree is trying its very best. And, you know, you're not going to lose anything. If you try to transplant it, just try to disturb the roots that you're able to get as little as possible. Always grab it by the trunk. Always grab it by the root ball. Don't ever grab it by the trunk. Water it in thoroughly with Super Thrive and Garrett juice when you transplanted it. I wish we'd had this discussion in December because that would have been a better time of year to do it.
Yeah, but that's what I kept telling somebody, but he didn't want to dig it up. All right.
Well, then tell him he can cut the new hole in the garage for a new door.
Yes. All right, final question. I have a very large philodendron in a pot, a very large pot, and my leaves are turning yellow, and then it slowly goes down the stem, and the whole thing dies. And I have super thrived this. I have has to grow it. I don't know what, and I was very careful with it over the winter to keep it covered.
Sure.
So we didn't get any burn issues. And it just, it starts at that leaf, and it just kind of dies all the way back down to the main stem.
And all what that is all one leaf. The part that's dying back is called the petiole, and that's just a leaf stem. So basically, you've got a leaf dying is what you have. Now, is this a big enough plant that it's got the roots coming out all up and down the trunk and wandering over and taking up the whole area? Yeah, it wishes it was in the jungle where all those roots could go down to the ground and start growing into the ground. It's in a, you know, like you said, a big pot, and you can't really go to a bigger pot.
Mm-mm.
If that plant is really special to you and you really want to keep it growing, what you are going to have to do is cut the top out of it. You're going to have to cut that main stem where you've still got several roots above the cut point and the top of the plant, and then put that into a new pot. The base will put out additional plants will come out from the side. In time, once they get some roots, you can cut those away and put them in a separate pot. But your plant is what is referred to as monopodial, which means 1 foot. It's got this stem going up. And the other choice is, you know, do what would happen in the jungle. Put some sort of stake in there to hold it upright. And instead of concentrating on what you put in the soil in the pot, you're going to have to foliar feed it. You're going to have to spray and water those roots that are up toward the top of the plants, because the roots that are in the pot are probably largely rotten and dead now. So the plant's a bit weak because it's being totally supported by those aerial roots that it's putting out. And in, you know, our hot, dry air, those roots, I mean, you water, they're going to be dry a few hours later. In the jungle, that's not a big deal where it rains every day. But it's just, it's basically a big plant with a very weak base and root system. And like I say, if this is a plant that you're attached to, cut the top out of it, kind of bend those roots around in enough of a circle that you could get them into another fairly large pot, fill the soil in, and it'll take off and grow, and we'll have the same conversation 10 years from now, you know, once it gets back in the same position. But basically, the top of the plant's doing well. The base of the plant is not, and so it requires a bit of surgery to keep it going.
Okay. I had wondered, because I kept looking for bugs, thinking surely something is eating it this.
No. And it's not really a split leaf. It's what you should call a philodendron psylloum. The true split leaf is a monstera that's a different, very interesting plant that is also can grow. Well, the name monstera, you can guess what it grows up into. Mm-hmm. But yours is actually a philodendron psylloum. And like I say, if it's not something you really care about, give it to a friend and let them worry with it. But if you wanna save that plant, cut the top off, pot the top separately, and you'll be set for several more years.
Okay. That'll get me going. I'll go get the azomite and get started on the cherry laurels.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, Susie. Thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye. David, hang on just a second. We've got to get a commercial break in here. You're up next.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be David and Kathy and John. David is up for... Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Let me preface my question by telling you, here's my limited knowledge of electricity. If you let the smoke out of something, it quits working. Okay.
All right.
Yesterday, you and the dirt doctor were talking about paramagnetism. I know you brought this up before. My simple question, well, in my mind is, I just learned about electricity at my age. That's scary.
Uh-huh.
I never really realized until several years ago that when they say a ground in electricity, that ground actually goes into the ground. Mm-hmm. Does that do anything to the magnetism? Does it increase it? Does it have any effect on it? This is a worldwide deal.
Well, no, it doesn't change or increase it. The things that create, and paramagnetism is just a very, very low level of magnetism. And, of course, you know, any iron-based ore, iron, of course, doesn't, you know, occur as iron. It's made from some metallic elements that are mined, so to speak. But paramagnetism is the result of certain rocks being treated with extreme heat and in some cases with extreme pressure. The most common source of materials that are paramagnetic would be lava. And of course, when you we're hearing about this volcano erupting in Iceland, and that volcano has probably erupted many, many, many times over the geologic history of that area. Obviously, the newest lava is on the outside of the volcano. The oldest lava is toward the center of the volcano, and there is a difference in the amount of paramagnetism that's in the newer lava than in the older lava. But that's where most of the source of highly paramagnetic material comes from, is from either basaltic rock, which are what are called igneous, which were once liquid material, and from lava. Old Malcolm Beck and, you know, some other folks had a huge, huge pile of pallets out on Highway 90 east of town a few years ago. I mean, this pile of pallets was probably 40, 50 feet tall, and somehow in the middle of the night that thing caught on fire, and it made one incredible hot bonfire. Fortunately, it was enough out in the open that the fire folks were able to just let it burn down and burn out. And when they tested the soil underneath that huge bonfire, it had picked up a fair amount of paramagnetism. Now, because, you know, it wasn't of a basaltic type of rock or anything, I'm sure that paramagnetism didn't last a long time. But paramagnetism is created by, like I say, extreme heat and some pressure. The actual electric field, the EMR, they call it electromagnetic radiation, isn't nearly powerful enough to create a paramagnetic condition. And now I've told you most of what I know about it. My knowledge of electricity, I know the basics, and the most important is if it's any at all complex, hire an electrician to do the work for you. But it's an interesting field and it's a great question. Now, having said that, and I haven't had the experiment going long enough to give you an answer on this, but when we were down at the original gift market over in Atlanta back in January, there was a company selling a device with two little probes on the bottom of it and claiming that if you poke this down in the soil of your plants, and it had a solar collector up on top, and it said that it's going to collect the sun's energy, convert it to electricity, and that's going to help your plants grow. And I said, give me one and I'll try it. Well, I haven't been trying it long enough to give you an answer on that. But is there going to any truth to it or not? I have no idea whatsoever. Energy is energy, and it has to be in a form that a plant can absorb and use. So I honestly don't know about electricity. But the one other thing that I find interesting that I will tell you is, you remember when Mount St. Helens erupted in this country a few years back, and literally blew the top off of that volcano, and the so-called experts were saying, oh, it'll be 100 years before there's any vegetation back in that area. I flew over St. Helens a couple of years ago, flying up to Seattle, and there's an amazing amount of foliage and trees and everything regrowing on the top of that volcano far faster than anyone expected. And I have a very strong feeling that it's due to the fact that it's, you know, growing in paramagnetic rock. I'll also tell you, I think that's one of the reasons that the Hawaiian Islands have such lush vegetation, and that there's a lot of fresh lava there. And of course, you know, all the islands are originally igneous. They're originally formed by lava, and I think that's one of the reasons that Hawaii is so lush. But now I've told you just about everything I know about it.
Okay, well, that makes sense. One more thing before I go, and it happened yesterday and today. Mm-hmm. And I knew when to start calling in, especially on a Sunday morning. I hit redial 27 times and kept getting a busy signal.
Well,
I got about three in. I got connected and then immediately disconnected, and the same thing happened yesterday morning.
There's some problem in the station. Don We had a problem toward the end of the show yesterday where Don would put someone on hold, and then we couldn't re-engage that phone line. But I'm sure he probably had engineers working on it overnight. Knock on wood, we haven't had that problem today. But, yeah, that station's got a lot of old equipment in it, not just old people working it, like me and Don. But we've had some issues with that. Just trying to anticipate. I think our time delay is 9 seconds now, so you've got to, and that's mandated by the FCC. You've got to kind of anticipate, and hopefully in the future you won't have to hit redial quite so many times.
Okay. All right, Bob. Well, thanks for the information.
Great questions. I'll tell you, if this is really of interest to you, and obviously you have a very active mind, but there's a fellow passed away a few years ago, but his name is Phil, P-H-I-L, Callahan, C-A-L-L-A-G-H-A-N, and he actually wrote a couple of books on paramagnetism and rock powders, as he called them, and you might find it very interesting reading. I'm sure you can probably still find them online, but Google Phil Callahan, and there's some real good information. Howard and I were talking, like you said, a little bit about this yesterday, and he probably has at least some basic entries on DirtDoctor.com. But if it's something you really want to look at, go back and read a couple of Phil's books. They're absolutely fascinating. All right. Well, I guess that we got that taken care of. Let me see here. Let's go ahead and take one more call here, and that would be Kathy. Good morning, Kathy.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, I have two questions. The first question is, I have a calamondrin tree and a kumquat and a 5-gallon pot. Can you give me any tips on it? Is it going to be all right over winter, planted next to my lemon and lime trees? How do I care for it quickly?
Well, both of those are going to be about 5 degrees more cold hardy than lemons and limes. Limes are the least cold hardy. They will suffer at 32. Lemons are second in line. They'll suffer at 26. Your kumquats and your calamondins probably will go into the lower 20s, but it's hard to put a temperature on there because a prolonged cold is much more damaging than where it just dips down and comes right back up. But your calamondin, and take good care of that kumquat, because they are very, very hard to come by right now. But put a padlock on it. Don't tell anybody you have one, or they may visit in the middle of the night. But both of those are, they're not quite as hardy as satsumas are, but they are the most cold hardy, other than satsumas, of all the citrus. So if we go back to more typical winters, you won't have to worry about them. If you see we're going to have temperatures 25 or below, I would probably protect them.
All right. Second question is, I have an American persimmon. I planted it, I guess, last September. It doesn't have any buds on it yet, is it? And now the fuyu is blooming. It's got the leaves and everything. Is there a difference between the two? And I've superthrized it. I've put the azomite before I planted it, all that. Is it slower to come around than the fuyu, or?
Well, there are several different trees. Again, persimmon is a common name, and we have native persimmons that grow in the hill country that are not even.
Yeah, different. This is an American persimmon.
If it is the true Diospyros, if I remember, is the botanical name on it. It makes a smaller, it's very similar to the Asian persimmons, but the fruit's about a fourth the size. But if it's seed grown, it'll have to be 6 or 8 years old before it produces for the first time. If it's grafted, it can bloom and produce at any point. And you just pretty much have to look down at the very base of the plant and see if you see a graft point or if you just see a stem coming up out of the ground. That will tell you whether it was probably grown from a seed or whether it was grafted. If it's grafted, it can bud and bloom any time. If it's seed grown, it may not be mature enough yet.
Okay, third question. I bought a tree, and the woman told me that it was a yellow lollipop tree. I never heard of it. It looks like an acacia with yellow blooms, but the blooms look like my shrimp plant, except they're yellow. Do you know what that might be?
It probably is an acacia. How long have you had it?
Almost a year. It's been a pot.
Okay. Did you protect it over the winter months?
Yeah, I put them insulate over it plus a white sheet.
It probably, if you want to look it up, it is probably a plant whose common name is Empress Candlestick plant. And it looks like a giant, you know, one of what people call the lollipop plant, which is Apache sage. But it probably is acacia. Oh, golly. I have to think. But Empress Candlestick. Look up Empress Candlestick. It grows to be about 6 or 8 feet tall. It's a wonderful summertime plant. It makes many, many, many seeds as the flowers fade, but it is not going to be cold hardy, and it's probably going to get too big to protect it over the winter months. What I would suggest you do is, by all means, save seed, share seed, but every year, start a few new plants because it's going to get too big to try to protect over the winter months, and it won't take freezing weather at all.
I got it. Okay, do y'all have trichogramma and beneficial nematodes?
We did at the end of the day yesterday. I'd have to go look in the refrigerator. Why don't you call the nursery line, Wendy or not? Wendy will probably answer, and she can run back and tell you, be sure we've still got them in stock. This is a time of year when our inventory is very different for at 10 in the morning than it is in the 4 in the afternoon. So I know we had plenty of them when I left at 5:30 yesterday, but I'm not sure who's been in there this morning. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
You're sure welcome. Thank you for the call this morning, Kathy. Appreciate it. Don, I guess we better get a break in here. John will be up first when we come back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to the phone lines. Going to be John and Janice and Sylvia. John is first in line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have son and daughter-in-law who have been in the military, and so they've been Italy, D.C., and various other places, but those are the two, well, Mississippi. So they have experience on all different kinds of soils.
Absolutely.
But, they're trying to incorporate all those into their San Antonio yard. So let me ask you, they picked up an olive tree. I suggested probably they're on a little bit of a slope, and I suggested probably the highest, rockiest, most well-drained part of the yard for that, but I wasn't sure what they had. Do have a low area that drains pretty well, you know, it catches water, but then it drains quickly, but I didn't think that would be probably perfect, it being Mediterranean in orientation.
Right. Well, the only problem is, the higher and more exposed it is, the more likely it is to be cold damaged. We grow a number of varieties of olives here, but, you know, if people didn't protect them back in 2021, an awful lot of olive trees died from the cold. And obviously, the more exposed they are, the more they suffer from that. The lower area, if I were going to plant an olive there, I would definitely create a raised bed or a bermed up area or whatever where trees can decide where they're going to put their roots. They'll generally do well even if the soil is relatively moist, if they have, you know, sort of an uplift area where they can get started. But do you know what variety of olives, if it was Mission or Arbicania, or which variety of olive it was?
I do not, Bob, and they haven't been in town long enough for me to get them by Shades of Green yet, so they went to a box store to buy this thing, so I need to get them over there while they're in this landscape.
Well, you know, we're not the only place that sells good plants, but the box store generally doesn't. I would ask them, look carefully and see if there's a tag on it. And Mission is slow-growing, longer-lived, slower to produce. Arbicania is probably the fastest growing of the olives and can be quite productive. There's still another one that's a compact plant called Little Ollie. There are lots and lots of different olives. And if you can get a name, I can probably tell you a little bit more about them. But what I would tell them is, you know, where they plant it, like you said, it needs to drain well, it needs to have full sun. But also, if it's like on the south side or something where it gets a little bit of winter protection, they'll be better prepared if we have another cold winter.
Okay. I wasn't aware that they were not cold hardy, so I put a note for that.
And one other thing, and if they spent time in Italy, they probably already know this, but an olive is not a fruit that you pick and eat. Olives have to be brined in order to be edible. In fact, it's my understanding, of course, you and I weren't around then, but in World War II, when our troops were fighting in Italy, if there was somebody they didn't like, they would tell them, hey, go pick some of those olives and eat them, and they would promptly lose their lunch or supper or whatever they had just eaten. So be sure that they understand if they're hoping to make olive oil or get edible olives, it takes a special process to do so. And tell them, please, do not get carried away with some of the other things that that look so good. The Italian cypress, which are so pretty throughout a lot of Italy, are a horrible choice for this area. Ask Greg Popovich about that, because he planted at his former home. I mean, I think he wanted it to look like Tuscany, and I spent more time trying to help him keep those things alive. So things that thrive in that Mediterranean climate don't always do well here. Olives have a fairly good chance of doing well if they get the right variety. So smart as most military people are, they might want to ask for some advice before they try to apply the climate of a different area to South Texas, because we're kind of unique, as you and I well know.
Right. Okay. A couple other things about their yard. They have a big split-leaf philodendron, the true Monstera. They just bought elephant ears to put in shady corners in the front of the house, but they have a split-leaf philodendron, has one stem sticking up and a bunch of old stems that are just sitting on top of the ground. Are those just decaying out and dying, or is the whole plant about gone? Should they be
it's probably going to come out, but that is not the true split-leaf philodendron. That's Philodendron siloam. Of course, that's a problem with common names. The true split-leaf, if you want to Google it and look at it, it's called a Monstera, M-O-N-S-T-E-R-A, and it will absolutely not survive a cold winter. The siloams suffered some cold damage, but, you know, most of them are coming back out. Ask them about their elephant ears. There are two types of elephant ears. There's one they call an upright elephant ear, or alocasia is its proper name, and it suffers if it gets very cold. The other true elephant ear bulb is called a colocasia, C-O-L-O-C-A-S-I-A, and it has a much more rounded bulb than it grows from. It is totally cold hardy, even a long way north of San Antonio, and it's the one that I recommend most highly. You don't get as many different varieties of colocasias as you do alocasias, but if what they have has kind of a projection, a pointed top coming out of the top of it, tell them to be sure and plant it in a semi-protected area, because it will very definitely suffer some damage in a cold winter. That's the alocasia. The colocasia, I planted those with my grandparents in Dallas, and that came back after even the colder winters in Dallas. It's just a hardier plant. So once again, that's a problem with common names. There's a lot to know beyond just elephant ear.
Yeah, theirs is pretty upright looking. I've only seen a photograph of it. She called me yesterday to ask about them, and it's pretty upright looking. I mean, all of the stems seem to be just going straight up. Now they may bend over here after they get longer, but and it's 3 feet tall out of the pot probably, and all the leaves are up high, not down on the, you know, not drooping already.
Yeah, so, well, the alocasia will have, like, definitely almost a trunk coming up out of the ground that the leaves come out from. The colocasia, you will not see any of the trunk. The leaves will all emerge at ground level. So that just will help you identify it a little bit, so, and make the decision about where it'll grow best. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's either one of them. It's fairly sheltered. It's on the southeast side of the house, in a corner, one corner facing east, one corner facing west, but still, yeah. The whole house is facing southeast.
Probably do well. All right, probably
and,
do well.
And a bird of paradise, the tropical bird of paradise. She brought it in Maryland. Can she put that in the ground?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's called a Cecilopenia. It will freeze back in the winter, but I've never seen it fail to come back out. Mine, I've got several of them.
Hang on. Cecilopenia the one, the Mexican bird of paradise?
Yeah.
No, I'm talking the one that has the actual flower that looks like the bird. The house.
Okay. That's called Strelitzia. And the white one is a little bit cold hardy. The orange one is not cold hardy at all. Those will have to remain in pots for their whole life.
Okay. Tell her that because she was going to stick that one in the ground. All right. Question. Do you have to ask for one more?
Go one more. Yeah.
And I'll ask many more if I can. But my on solarizing the soil, how much rain do we need to get before I can put my plastic out? And what time of year do I need to wait until? Not that we ever get 2 or 3 inches of rain in July if I need to wait that long.
Well, you need to wait until it's hot weather, you know, and you can judge if you parked your car out in the sun and it would be very uncomfortable to get into, then it's hot enough to do your solarizing, because that's what you're doing. You're just literally steam, you know, poaching in effect. You're boiling the stuff underneath it and killing it. It's, you know, death by steam heating. And so it needs to be really sunny. And the old car in the parking lot is the best thing I can compare it to. Typically, we start our solarization late June, July, August, sometimes into September.
Now, so to do that, I need a good watering first. How many inches of water would I need to put down? My backyard has died, so I'm just going to kill it and put some beds back there.
You would want to water thoroughly enough that you had the soil moist about 3 or 4 inches deep.
Oh, is that all? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is the second part of that question. Does it kill the nut grass? I know we've talked about nut grass poking through plastic.
Yeah.
So it'll kill the nuts and everything?
It will kill, and call it nut sedge, because it's not really a grass. It is a sedge, but it'll kill nut sedge.
Okay. Great. All right. Those are the main things I had. Who do I talk to about a pond? One of your advertisers does ponds, I believe.
I don't know.
I'm thinking of making a canoe into a pond.
Yeah.
You don't have one?
There is a club in San Antonio. I think it's just called the Water Garden Club or something like that. And there's a fella named Dwayne Eaton. He probably would be your best advisor. There's not really a company that builds ponds. There used to be a really neat guy named Alexis Abdaza that built a waterfall and things in Dr. Kirby's backyard, but I don't think Lexi's doing it anymore. But try to get hold of the Water Garden Club, and they can tell you, or Dwayne could tell you, who would be your best consultant on that.
Okay. I was just thinking that you had someone like Rhonda's Nature Toy. I was thinking that you had someone like Wild Birds Unlimited. What's the Wild Bird Place?
Yeah,
I think you had someone like that did ponds that advertised with you. I thought I'd remember hearing that. But,
no, okay. I never have, but I wish I did. So, John, you go have a good St. Paddy's Day. Let's get our last break of the hour in, Don, and something good after that, and then we'll have time for a couple of more calls. Leave it to my great engineer, Don Cooper Stevens, to come up with an Irish fishing song here on St. Paddy's Day. I don't know how you do it, Don. Anyway, sure makes life fun. Always look forward to that last break of the show. Now it's time to see that we can get Janice and Sylvia in before the end of the show. And Janice, you're first.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have crayon gall in my rose bed.
Okay.
how can I make my soil healthy again?
I would start out trying beneficial nematodes. Most of the rose galls are actually insect caused as opposed to being bacterial. To cover both bases, you might treat it with whole ground cornmeal first, and then do your beneficial nematodes. That way, I think you'll be covering, you know, both of the pathogenic galls that sometimes show up and the insect caused galls. That would be my suggestion.
Okay. And
are you there? Yeah, go ahead.
How long should I wait before I replant?
Sometime. Not real long. I would say by 2 or 3 months from now, you should be fine.
Okay, and just the nematodes and whole ground cornmeal.
Those are the two things that I would suggest. Now, if this were a botanical garden, I'd probably say solarize the soil like I was just talking with my last caller about. But don't think, you know, that that's going to be necessary. I would, where you can, I would go with roses that are grown on their own roots rather than grafted roses, because they always seem to be a little bit hardier. But, you know, I'd say if you do it immediately, probably by Mother's Day, you could replant.
All right. These are all antique roses.
Oh, so they would be own root roses. That's good.
Yes.
And you can actually take cuttings from those if you like and start fresh plants to put out.
Mm-hmm. Good. And what about mycorrhizal fungi? Would that be any benefit?
If you're using a good fertilizer, it probably already has some mycorrhizae in it. If you want to be sure, there's a great company up in Bernie, David Steinbrenner, and his folks make a good mycorrhizal inoculant that you'll probably find at both nurseries. You'll never go wrong with increasing mycorrhizae around the root system of all your plants. There are only a handful of plants in the world that don't benefit from mycorrhizal fungus. So, no, I think that'd be an excellent idea.
All right. And I was listening to Terralot as a new product. Is that right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Did lava sand do that same thing, add moisture to the soil?
It helped attract moisture to the soil, but it didn't actually physically hold the moisture. Terralock formed something that would remind you of, if you can imagine, jello in the soil. So it's accomplishing the two different things with two different, or accomplishing the same thing with two different products. And now, in all fairness, Janice, I'm going to let you go so Sylvia can have her 3 minutes. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about a Meyer lemon.
Okay.
It gave 14 lemons last year.
Good.
And this winter it had thousands of buds on it. And then, of course, it eventually fell off. But now I notice that the tips of the branches are turning brown.
The leaves are turning brown, or the actual branches?
The actual branches.
Okay.
And it doesn't hardly have any leaves on it either.
Okay. And is this in a pot or is it in the ground?
It's in a pot.
Okay. I would very definitely, you know, fertilize it with Hastagrow or use some Garrett juice. I suspect that it's getting a little too dry between waterings. As you've heard me say before, there's no such thing as overwatering, but there is watering too often. And what you're describing frequently happens when it's getting watered often enough, but the whole pot is not getting soaked enough. So you need to be careful that you really, really, really soak it when you water, but then let it go till it's dry about an inch deep before you water again. If you go ahead and give it some Garrett juice, give it some Hastagrow plant, that should stimulate new growth and should very definitely help it.
Okay. Should I cut off the tips that are brown?
It won't make
really
a whole lot of difference.
It's 6 to 8 inches, so.
Yeah. It will certainly make it, you know, more attractive, but it won't, this is not something that's going to spread, you know, it's not like a bacteria or something like that. Okay. So whether you leave them or not, cut them off, it won't make any difference to the health of the lemon tree, but it very definitely will make it more attractive if you cut off that dead tissue.
We had it in the garage, and so I wasn't watering as much because I didn't want water all over the garage.
Yeah, I think that probably, in that case in the future, water with ice. You know, just dump a few cups of ice. Ice melts so slowly that it will all be absorbed by the soil rather than making a mess in your garage. And that's we did that for years with plants in restaurants and places where the owners didn't want them dripped on plants. That was way in my early years of the plant business. But you get out and have a good St. Patty's Day. It's time for Dr. Kirby. He'll be in here momentarily with the pet show. We'll do plants again next Saturday morning right here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.